welcome to In Beta, a semi-regular conversation between physiotherapy educators who are interested in curriculum reform, innovation and critical thinking about teaching and learning. My name is Ben Ellis. I'm a lecturer in physiotherapy at Oxford Brookes University in the UK.
And I'm Michael Rowe, a lecturer in the Department of Physiotherapy at the University of the Western Cape in South Africa.
So just to kind of set the tone, hopefully, for what we're aiming to do, for anyone who's not engaged with anything that we've done with In Beta before, the aim of this is in no way to set ourselves out as being experts. So my thought here was that everyone's being asked to do a really sort of sudden, quite seismic shift in how they teach, and that the best way to approach that is probably not for everyone to kind of come up with their own ideas, which is going to be massively kind of labor and cognitively intensive, and that there's probably stuff out there that people are already doing or have thought about doing, and that we could sort of try and share some of that practice. So that's where we're coming into it. So I'm hoping that this is going to be a conversation. It's certainly not going to be me talking and kind of giving all of my ideas. I'm hoping that people have got some things or some thoughts that they'd be happy to share. I've put on the thing, so if you can open the Google Doc, we're going to try and run that sort of consecutively along with this as it goes. So at the bottom of, so that Google Doc, I've split into a couple of sections. It would be great if people have got videos and things that they use for teaching practical skills, or for kind of case studies or anything like that. If you'd be happy to share links, you don't need to do that during the chat, but adding them afterwards would, I think, be really helpful for people. So there are resources that other people can access. So please do go onto the Google Doc and contribute. Then at the bottom of that, there's some sections for sort of ideas about teaching practical skills online. And those might be ideas that you have already had or you're already doing, or it might just be stuff that kind of crops up in the conversation here. And if you hear an idea and it's not on there, then please do add it in there. We'll try and sort of collate that stuff as we go. And if you also want to tweet, then if you're tweeting about it, if you could use the hashtag In Beta, then that'll allow us just to collate anything that's kind of being put out on Twitter afterwards too, which would be great. Thanks. I don't think there's anything else from a housekeeping perspective. Anything, Michael, that I've missed?
Not that I can think of. Good to go.
Cool. Okay. So, couple of questions that have cropped in the chat already. Somebody saying if they've got resources which aren't in English. I mean, it would be great if you could add them to the doc, because they may be of use to some people. So I've been really surprised at the interest in the website that we put together. It was accessed like 600 times in the last couple of days, and that is really broad across the world. So even if there's a resource that you think may not be of useful, may not be of use to everybody, there may be one or two people for whom it is helpful. So please do share. Just make a note, maybe, if it's in a language not English. Well, the assumption will be that things are in English unless it's flagged. And obviously, any videos which would be breaching patient confidentiality to share, then we're not expecting
them
to do that.
Hi, listeners. At this point in the recording, Ben lost his internet connection, and since he was the one who was recording the audio, we lost a few minutes of conversation. During that section, we had two or three people sharing some examples of how they had some experience with using videos for training their undergraduate students. And we pick up again with Michael Cole. Michael, do you want to have a go and just let us know what your experiences of doing this kind of remote practical training have been?
Okay, thanks. Hi, everyone. Similar to Gal, we don't have a solution for the cervical manual therapy that we're teaching. So our plan at the moment is to return to that in September, basically. But in terms of using video and remote learning, our level 4 and 5 soft tissue therapies, peripheral MOBs, we have them doing a video portfolio. So they do it live practically with us, but they can submit evidence via videos in their OneNote portfolio in Microsoft Teams. And then they do other things with like audio clips. So they'll record themselves doing a subjective part of the examination. And we also have a bank of videos stored within the university shared drive for specific techniques. So the basics of, you know, soft tissue massage, we've got some range of motion testing, muscle testing, special tests, that type of thing. And the same for the MOBs at level 5. So they've got this bank of videos that they can use as well. But that's it in a nutshell. Happy to have any questions.
Thanks, Michael. Ash, you also had some experience?
Yeah, so hello, everyone. Just for a bit of context, I don't work for a university or a higher education institute. I am the education lead for a private physiotherapy provider, so we're a little bit different in that we have formal education programs, but they're normally taught face-to-face, so we don't have a big bank of videos that we've used previously in teaching. So we're kind of doing it on the fly, which I'm sure a lot of people are at the moment, and you know, not too dissimilar from what people have already described. My dog's going to bark. In that we have just got educators to film themselves doing practical where possible in terms of assessment. I told you. Quiet. She's not going to be quiet. But yeah, not too dissimilar from what other people have already said, really.
Thanks, Ash. It seems that people who have got some experience with doing this kind of thing have built up video libraries, and maybe a little bit later we can check back in with everyone and see what the possibilities are of sharing some of those libraries. I'd also be interested to know how much of the libraries are annotated with some kind of contextual information, so either some text or a voiceover narrative where people are saying what's happening, or is it just literally a video dump? So maybe we could come back to that. Marianne, you also had something. I think Marianne and Adnil both commented that this was an adjunct to what you were doing. Maybe Marianne, you could let us know what your experience is at Stellenbosch.
Yes, hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, can you clearly?
Right, great. So, yes, I was actually started off with a project about 3 or 4 years ago, rather as a sort of intervention to address our increasing class sizes. So our students also are asked to compile a video portfolio. So over a period of a year, they submit weekly videos of techniques that we have told them to execute for that particular week, which we upload onto our learning management system and which is then peer assessed. And so over the last 3-4 years, we have an enormous bank of an enormous amount of videos, some of course far better than others. But neither here nor there, we haven't actually made videos for teaching purposes specifically, although as part of the project, we've generated a lot of what we would call benchmark videos. So before students peer assess, the video is made available of what it should look like, and then they can self-assess and peer assess. But something I just quickly want to say, seeing that I have the floor, is that I think we shouldn't be too nervous about making perfect videos or perfect benchmark videos. I think the opportunity now that we're all forced to do everything online is use the faulty video or less perfect video and turn that into an assignment for students. Because as previous speakers have mentioned, some students will be living alone and cannot practice on each other. So, you know, one other add-on or adjunct until we can meet again and have practical camps to catch up, so to speak, you know, is use some of the flawed materials and generate debates and conversations around, you know, what's good and what's bad, etc.
Thanks, Marianne. I think the, you know, something that you've mentioned, which I haven't come across before, is this idea of the students doing the work and then getting feedback from each other. So peer assessment and then also the self-evaluation of the work that they are doing. I see quite a few questions coming up in the chat about the peer assessment. And maybe what we could do is we could ask, if you don't mind, Marianne, or anyone else who has experience with things like having students peer assess their work, is that we try to collect some of those resources and we'll put it into the shared Google folder. So if, for example, you do have this peer assessment form that you'd be prepared to share, maybe we could add that to the Google folder, because I think a lot of people have been interested. I see Louisa's asked about an ethical issue. Louisa, can you just jump in quickly before we move on and let us know what your concerns are?
Thanks. Can I just clarify? Was that one of the students' videos, poorly done videos that you were going to use for critique, or was it one of the educators' videos done poorly for critique? Because if it's a student's one, a previous student's product, then obviously that I'm not sure that's ethical.
Did you get that, Marianne? Marianne,
did people hear me?
We heard you, Louisa. I'm just wondering if Marianne heard you. I saw she was typing to.
Sorry, yes, I muted myself by mistake. No, just to answer the ethical question. So our students sign informed consent at the beginning of the year, and that if they obviously have themselves recorded, that and they post it, that implies that they are giving informed consent. The problem at the moment is that it is for in-house purposes only, and the videos are uploaded onto our learning management system. So we would have to consider, so all the students whose videos we do decide to share more widely, we would have to contact them to ask them for permission to do so. That's the one option. The alternate option is that we edit them all and blur out the faces or whatever, but that's quite a bit of work. I think it's easier just to contact them and ask for consent.
Would it be easier for us to produce something that was variable quality and doing a couple of good ones and a couple of less worthy ones so that students could comment?
Absolutely. I think there's a lot of ways in which one can do it. Students might feel more comfortable with you doing the less perfect execution versions than using each other. I'm sure that's perfectly acceptable. Might in fact be a good idea.
Thanks, Marianne and Louisa. I see Pam would like to share an idea. Would you like to jump in, Pam?
Must I unmute?
You're good to go, okay. Pam. We can hear you well.
Okay, great. I'm a physio from Cape Town, South Africa, and my practice was involved in helping anybody do more and better what they wanted to do and what they needed to do. So I became used to using videos over WhatsApp. So I had a number of people with small babies, for instance, one in America and one in Australia. And what I'd get them to do was to video what the child was doing. So that's your first part of your contrast, and follows on very well with what the previous person was saying. So they would video what the baby was doing, how they were trying, for instance, to help the baby, enable the baby to crawl. And then I would get somebody to take a video of me using my doll and send it back to them, so that instead of correcting what they were doing, I was building on what they were doing. So I know this is different from teaching students, but I feel it might be a very useful way to do that sort of principle-based learning. This is only possible if there's somebody there to video them. But I found it worked enormously well, because we had an ongoing basis for interaction, and we could move from stage to stage or activity to activity, and we both found it a huge amount of fun. And then of course they could always send me a progress report and we could celebrate the successes. So I think that approach can be very useful, using videos and exchange of videos, but one would have to work out how to translate that into classroom use. Thanks.
Thanks, Pam. I really like the idea of having in your example, parents taking videos of their kids, sending it to you, and then you kind of sending a response as another video. So even though you're not practicing in the same environment with the same models or people, I think that could still work quite well in the context that we find ourselves in.
Can you still hear me?
Yep.
Okay. You see, then it can be used and seen by anybody that, for instance, was dealing with a child. But I would do the same with an adult with stroke or somebody like me. I'm a quadriplegic myself currently for the last couple of years. But I would do the same thing there, because then anybody involved with the person could get a better idea of how to do it. And so if you went back to the sort of practical stuff of how to, and the communication aspects of how to engage with a patient, for instance, that's in a wheelchair. I mean, you've no idea how frustrating it is being in a wheelchair and having people talking down to you from behind you, slapping you on the back, that sort of thing. So one could go into the more, and then save the more detailed techniques for as you get, you know, for the day that you're back. Thanks.
Thanks, Pam. That's a really great example, and I think there's quite a few discussions in the chat for people who may want some additional information, and maybe we could get in touch with you a little bit later, and we can share some of that in text in the document. I'm just having a look at the discussion. Yep. There was a question from Ben a little bit earlier about where these videos are being recorded, and I think it was directed to Marianne. Are the students recording at home or in a practical lab setting? And I think he's setting up the context where we know that our students don't actually have access to those environments now. Are we going to be asking students to do their recordings at home on their beds? I don't know if that's where you were going with that, Ben.
So I think the thought I was having around this is that in terms of getting an exemplar video resource up now, I don't think any of us educators or students are in the facilities to be able to do that. And I think that does then raise some issues around sort of ethics and safety in terms of who the students trying to find to practice this on, and are they putting themselves at risk doing that. So it felt like observing ones that have already been made is a really good start point, but that it might be also then worth getting students to think. So the sort of second comment that I'd then put in the chat was that what you could then move that teaching activity on a little bit. So from here are some examples of an assessment that might be done looking at some tip or whatever, and then get them to think, okay, if you're doing that now, so you're not able to be in contact with that person, so you've got to do it over a Skype call or, you know, something like that. What aspects of the assessment could you do? So there's a problem solving element that makes use of the sort of teachable moment that's happening right now, and is more realistic. So that what the students are doing is not feeling like they've got to try and replicate something they can see on a perfect video being done well at home. We can save that for when they come sort of back in, but that might be, they might then be able to produce something as video or a small group discussion that's happening asynchronously that they could then be chatting about in a group and be getting feedback on for how to kind of take the ideal clinical skills and then put them into a sort of home setting, which isn't just relevant to the coronavirus issue, but is also then thinking, you know, if you're going to see someone who can't get out of the home, kind of more community-based therapy, it has some nice overlaps into that.
If I can add to that, Michael, in South Africa, the last point that you just made about relevance to home and community settings, that is exactly why we encourage our students to record themselves wherever they may find themselves, so in their room or in their houses, and we encourage them to come up with creative ways if this is not the optimal. You don't have a plinth, how do you use a table, etc. And we, not that we score them or give them credit for, but I mean, that's something one could consider, you know, for novelty, creative ways of problem solving, because in essence, I think what we're trying to do, because I mean, how many, we have 300-400 different techniques we want to teach our students. It's really excessive that we come up with a way of generating principal sort of approach to assessment. And then that the students must then apply wherever they are and come up with ways to ensure that they meet the criteria as far as the principles are concerned, but that the actual place or position or, you know, is then adapted according to the environment.
Can I say something?
Thanks, Marianne.
Hello, everyone. I wanted to just make a comment, really, because we've got a group of apprentices who are going through at the moment who are due to do a 15-minute PowerPoint presentation with, and within it a link, a two-minute demonstration of how they are doing a particular technique. And we have decided that it's really difficult for them to actually do that, to record it appropriately. So what we are asking them to do is take some photos, because they will have video recording things, and then to talk over what they're doing, so where they're putting their hands, what they're feeling, what degree of movement they're doing end pressure and things like that. So we're asking them to really carefully talk it through, considering how they would introduce themselves, ask for consent and all that sort of thing as they're going through it, so that you get around the issues of video recording. But they are only first year students, and we have time to pick up on their actual technique properly further through on in their training. So I suppose we've got the benefit of time. I think if you've got students further on in the course, it might be more pressing to actually watch them doing a full technique. So that's just our thoughts anyway.
Yeah, just to build on that really, and maybe throw in a bit of a curveball actually, in that, do we have an opportunity now, when we think about the key principles of learning and cementing learning, when we talk about interleaving, elaboration and retrieval practice and things, if we're doing an online session of practical techniques and then they don't have the opportunity to practice that very often in different contexts, you know, are we just leading them down a path where they're going to learn it for a couple of days and then not use it, and then you're going to have to reteach them anyway? Are we in a position now where everyone is remote to work on things like communication, motivational interviewing, things that they can practice more readily? Can we really cement that in now and then almost worry about the practical elements further down the line? Bit of a curveball, but it'd just be good to get people's thoughts on it.
I think there's a few people that definitely agree. I think we definitely will be able to do some of what you said much more easily remotely. So you mentioned communication and maybe some of those soft skills. Trying to do the practical sessions remotely with video is difficult. One of the things that we are going to struggle with here in South Africa is that we're going to get to a certain point where we hit some deadline after which we don't have enough time to complete the program in the year. And so I think one of the things that we're trying to do is, you know, do some planning around this, not because we think that this is the best solution, but because we may get to the point where we have to hold back an entire cohort because we haven't been able to complete the program in time. I don't think anyone's suggesting that this is going to be the way that we should be moving forward. At this point, I think we're just trying to put out as many fires as possible. And you mentioned there's, the chat is getting away from me. I know that lots of people have asked questions, and we've been trying to pull those people in. I saw one question Lucy wanted to ask about how has anyone used this to support clinical practice? And maybe this touches with what you were saying, Ash. We could use videos to support clinical practice with practical techniques. But a lot of the other things that we're doing at the moment could also support clinical practice. So the kinds of reasoning that you might expect students to do with just text-based tasks. Does anyone have any for Lucy, just about how your experience with using this specifically to support clinical practice? Ash, you sounded like you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, sorry, I was just waiting to see if anyone else did. Yeah, so we very much use it as an opportunity because our like I said before, you know, the physios that we work with are now practicing, so they're not in university anymore, and all of our sessions are now remote, so they're not getting to practice those skills even in clinical practice. Everything we do now is telephone or video consultation for the time being. So we've very much gone down the road of moving towards more clinical reasoning type exercises, and looking at what we can measure objectively without physically being there. So what objective tests can we do without actually doing any objective tests, particularly for neurology point of view. So getting people to do sit to stand instead of usual dermatomal and myotomal tests. So I think we're definitely moving towards the clinical reasoning side of things for now, and we'll revisit the hands-on practical objective assessment stuff further down the line.
Well, I'll just jump in there, Ash, because you're obviously in clinical practice. I just put a question in the chat about, so one of the difficulties in education is sometimes getting good quality patient case studies and videos, that kind of thing. Do you think that that this is an opportunity actually to ask patients if they're happy for some of their online consultations to be recorded and for them to give consent for those to be used as a teaching resource that could then be kind of shared and put into use? Because there's no reason not to. We have some of those resources from people where we've recorded it in kind of clinical environments. In some ways, this seems like an easy sort of setup, and that could give some really nice insight into what clinicians are having to do, and as you say, how they're sort of adapting assessments that students can watch, reflect, discuss why the clinician did what they did, and that kind of thing.
I think that's a really valuable point, actually, something I hadn't thought of, and I think that's a really good idea to try and get across to students and people who are learning the ways in which you can adapt it, and the way that which advanced practitioners or more experienced clinicians use their communication skills to elicit the same kind of conclusion at the end of an assessment. They can get to the same place in the majority of cases without doing any hands-on objective examination. And I think it's really important for the students to be able to see that. And personally, I think we're going to come out the other end of this, probably practicing in a different way altogether anyway. I think we'll find that patients' attitudes might change towards online consultations. They might think, do you know what, I didn't get any massage or acupuncture and my shoulder's feeling a little bit better anyway. I think it might just start to change the public perception of what is needed from a treatment consultation.
Yeah, great. Thanks. I'm conscious there was a couple of people who'd put their hand up, one of whom was Matt Zasada, and the other one is Lucy. Can we just go to Matt, because I think his was up before, and then we can come back to Lucy after that.
Hi, Ben. Thanks very much. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Brilliant. What I was going to say, some really good ideas. I was just thinking about our particular context. So I'm the musculoskeletal module lead and course director at St George's in London, and our student body is very diverse, and we've got several students in halls. I don't know if anyone else is in that situation, but they've basically been told they cannot leave. So there's no way they can do anything practical, basically, on each other. They are on their own. And we're setting up virtual support groups and things for them. But we have a large number of other students in the same position. So listening to what people were saying, it's great ideas, but I'm conscious none of those would particularly work for us. But what does occur to me, something that we did a few years ago now, trying to think how long, 7-8 years ago, is we looked pedagogically, that word had to come eventually, didn't it? We looked pedagogically at how we were delivering content generally. And we turned things on its head slightly. It was triggered by a conversation initially with Nikki Petty several years ago, when she pointed out that a mobilization is a mobilization is a mobilization, and it, you know, if it's a joint mobilization is basically the same conceptually. The thing you need to understand is what's happening with, say, joint biomechanics. So what we did is we went and looked at the pedagogy and started looking at the stuff around threshold concepts. What we did is we mapped musculoskeletal as an area of practice, and identified where there are threshold concepts. So those are the things that turn the practical skill into something that is meaningful. So the way all our content is now delivered is there'll be a lecture, there'll be some sort of transmit learning that'll be a video or a bit of reading or whatever it might be, a lecture that brings all that stuff together discursively, and then we go on to a tutorial where we'll really chew into that The tutorial normally comes after practical, so they've had the threshold concept and they've tried to put it together, and the tutorial is where we then make it really, really meaningful. What we're looking to do, and with all the temporary register stuff at the moment, you know, it's been very hard to get this work done. We've got 3 weeks to do it, but we're trying to rebuild the end of the first year, so it's threshold concept led. We're mapping all the teaching that's left to come, plucking out the practical, and then establishing what are all the philosophical, educational, clinical, whatever concepts that make practical skills meaningful, so that we can teach all of that, but then hold off all of our practical stuff probably until August, September, when we'll probably bring the students back for an intense, what looks like 3 week block, to then do the practical stuff. So in terms of practical teaching, my main reason for joining was I was hoping someone would have a magic cure-all for the challenges we've got, which, not too surprisingly, I don't think anyone's got. But if you're in a similar boat to us, that might be a way of looking at it. Michael Cole's just coming in. It's threshold concept stuff. It's been around for a while. It's not new. I think it's just not always been that well applied in physio practice. In terms of the amount of prac we do, our prac stayed the same. What we did find is our placement grades, and we mapped for five years after, and we've seen a consistent uplift of almost a grade boundary on clinical placement. So there may even be scope to reduce the amount of practical there as well. I'll stick a paper up there if anyone's interested in the threshold concept stuff. And no, I have got the data for it, and no, I haven't written it up and published it yet. And yes, I am getting it. But yeah, that's all I wanted to say. Thanks very much.
No, that's great. And if you're happy to sort of share anything within that, that would be good. Just to ask a follow-up question, which I think relates to something that Ash brought up earlier. In terms of the pedagogy, seeing as we're on that, do you think it is important that those things happen in a kind of just-in-time way? And is there a risk that we lose the potential learning by sort of doing half of something now and then trying to come back to the practical bit of it in September? Are we going to end up, you know, just kind of having to actually go back over everything again at that point? Because I think I kind of came into this thinking, should we really be trying to do all this practical stuff online? You know, are we better just to draw a line under it and kind of go, well, we'll come back to it when we can? Or do you think that you can get enough engagement from the students with the ideas and sort of watching examples and things that's useful to them, that is still going to be there to build upon when they then come back later on in the year?
I think the nature of us all being online is basically everything's asynchronous. Ideally you want a just-in-time model, and that's kind of why we have that cyclical pattern that we have in the musculoskeletal modules and the first year module, which are much more blended across discipline. Because we're asynchronous, you lose that just-in-time component. I think that's where your VLE becomes vital. That you need to be making sure that the concepts that you're talking about, it's clear in the VLE structure how those concepts link into what you're doing practically later. But I think we're going to need to go one step further than, say, we've done in the past, where we've said, well, soft tissue, my favourite thing, how does soft tissue behave? Then we need to talk, we'll have talked about pain, we'll talk about soft tissue, and then we'll say, do you remember back when? We need to find a much more complex way of stitching all those bits and pieces together so that students can see how that jumps out. It depends on the VLE that you're using, to be honest, and which version you're on. We're now on Canvas, which is great for that if it's set up properly. We've only had it for a couple of years, so I've got people who are going to have to upskill very, very, very quickly on Canvas and how to do more complicated integration there. If you've got an in-house version, say, of Moodle that you've got in-house programmers running, you'll be able to do that because your in-house guys will be able to set that up for you. But if you're using a more off-the-shelf version, you'll struggle. And I think Blackboard, unless it's changed since I used it a couple of years ago, that's very much a sequence learning design, just the way it's put together. So you'll struggle with that. So I think BLEs are going to be a challenge with all of these things. But ultimately, you should be able to get engagement. It's about how you signpost and how you structure.
Right. Thank you.
Very quickly, the one thing I was going to say that I thought was a really nice idea. Pam, I agree. Asynchronous can be used to promote interaction. Absolutely. One of the things that we would be really nice is if we could get these imperfect videos somehow, because if you've taught a threshold concept and you conceptually understand what's going on, you should be able to look at something and then critique it, which means you've got learning. And then when you come back to do the sat down practical bit later, you have a greater understanding conceptually before you even stick your hands on. Whereas normally we do it the other way around, don't we?
And I think that ties in with that idea of having to kind of take an idea and then figure out how could I apply this now over a call or in someone's home. You have to understand the concept to be able to think about how you do it in a non-perfect way, you know. So I think it does all pull together. I think a lot
definitely.
Of those are. I'm going to come to Lucy, who's had her hand up. It's probably aching now. I don't know if you've been doing your PE with Joe already this morning. Joe, what's his name? Lucy, go for it.
Can you hear me, first of all?
Yeah.
Yeah, great. Sorry, I'm going back a couple of points. I just wanted to have a chat about the kind of the utility of real life clinical practice. I think it's probably due to the fact that I'm only about 6 months into higher education, having come from clinical practice, and I'm feeling, and cardiorespiratory specialty as well, that I'm feeling very strongly that A, I want to be involved with the crisis, and B, I want to really use it as a learning opportunity with our students, because I think it's you know, it's an unprecedented kind of clinical circumstances that we're going to have to learn from for the future. I was just interested to hear from anyone else if A, you've got a relationship with your local trust, and as to whether or not there are any, if there is an ability to set up that relationship to do videos of real life practice of clinical educators with patients, obviously given that there's consent naturally, but I'm just wondering about the utility of that and making it, as Matt was saying, making it meaningful and kind of using this situation to our advantage.
So the question's there. If anyone does have any of that, any links or tried to do that, either let us know in the chat. I can see that Matt's hand is up. Do you want to come back in on that point, Matt?
We're co-located. St George's University is co-located with St George's Hospital in Tooting. We're trying to get stuff that's meaningful from them and from the centre called the London Southeast Area Tracks LCAP. It's got a ridiculous name. Anyone that's in it will know it. The problem we're finding is that everyone is so up against it that they're really struggling. Our hope is that potentially Project Nightingale, so anyone who's not UK, Project Nightingale is we're setting up a massive, huge hospital in the Excel Centre in London, and that's all turned around in what a week, pretty much. There's lots of resources that are being pulled together there, and what we're hoping is some of those resources we might then be able to use other teaching, but it is going to be very specifically respiratory and more acute based stuff. It's not going to help. It's not going to help me solve my module problem, but it will help other people. Just a thought that's out there.
Great, thanks. I don't know whether, I mean, it feels like it's going to be a tough ask maybe to get kind of clinicians to be recording treatments with patients in the very short term, but that maybe there are those opportunities to be having, you know, sort of clinical discussions, debriefing things, and trying to sort of set up calls where that could happen outside. I don't know whether anyone, there's a few people in the chat talking about using various video conferencing apps and other things to get interaction. But I think, yeah, as you can see from Angie, that there's sort of such a degree of uncertainty and in the clinical side, people trying to work out where they need to be and being moved around, that, you know, trying to get in there, unless it's someone who's got a dual role, you know, so maybe those are the people who have got the biggest opportunity to kind of do that. And then I guess that probably comes back to the question that I was asking of Ash, and if those resources are able to be recorded, whether there's then any scope for that, if people are getting patient consent or clinician consent to record something, thinking bigger picture, and rather than just sharing that with the university that's right next to you, you know, but doing it in a way that would then be accessible to other people and sort of sharing that through would I think be really helpful, where any of those resources are being made.
Can I just come in very quickly on that one?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess what I was getting at, again, probably specific to cardiorespiratory, but such as myself, if I'm hoping that I'm going to be able to go and support the crisis, and whether or not I could be that link person was what I was getting at, to be able to facilitate that, because I'm in a unique position of having that duality, really. But yeah, it's not easy.
No, great. And a good point from... Sorry, go on. Who was that?
Sorry, it was me again. And I will be quiet in a minute. Just building on from that, and it is very difficult, I imagine, in the hospitals now to get anything like that done, just with the situation as it is. But just if people aren't aware, there's some... Rachel Moses via Twitter has put out some really good stuff. It's not live on a patient, but she's got a schedule of CPD where they're going live every day and a respiratory member of staff is talking through equipment scenarios. So if people are in a cardiorespiratory environment, I think they're really, really useful. And as I've been looking through resources for redeployment of some of our staff from a live scenario point of view, there's a really good website called the respiratoryacademy.co.uk, and I'll make sure this is on the document. It's free. They're free CPD modules to sign up to. And there's lots of scenario based learning in there that you can work through. And it's free. So just for those in a cardiorespiratory environment, they're two really useful resources that I've found.
Lucy, what a few of my colleagues are doing at the university, from a respiratory background, is they've actually gone back into the hospitals. University have released them to do that, and they're training up all the staff for redeployment, so they're being involved in that exact way, which I think is probably one of the ways that you can get easily involved again if you don't have a trust post anymore.
Yeah, that's what I've been trying to do unsuccessfully, waiting on a memorandum to happen, and it's not happening at the moment, so I'm really frustrated that I've got the skills. Yeah, exactly.
Yes, thanks. Elizabeth, Liz Sargent, got your hand up. Do you want to come in?
Yes, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. I just, I'm sorry if I'm changing direction here again, but I was wondering about using videos and uploading them to our learning management system, concerns about bandwidth and overloading systems and things like that. Does anybody have recommendations for where to keep those videos? If the learning management system isn't capable of doing that, we use Blackboard here. And we've tried to use our university wide streaming system and nothing has been terribly successful. So I was just wondering if there was some sort of external bank that people are using to store videos.
We've successfully set up YouTube channels that are private for our students in the past, which is one option. But normally Blackboard or Cope is our sort of findings at Leicester.
Yeah, I'd probably echo that we've done ones through a shared Google Drive, and putting things onto YouTube, keeping it private, seems to work relatively well, and then they can be kind of integrated into whatever VLE is being used. It looks like people are using Vimeo and others. So I think yeah, try not to sort of share the whole file, but putting it somewhere where it can be streamed is
Right, especially because I'm using my daughter as the subject and my husband is the camera person. So I don't want that out there in the world.
Yeah, sure. No, and I think that is tricky. Kids of kind of physio educators often get a raw deal in terms of their privacy, I think, being compromised.
Absolutely.
But yeah, so I think it's about working out how you can kind of keep that constrained. But those kind of private links could do it. It's, and then just being clear, I guess, with the people who are accessing it, that that it's not to be shared on. And maybe only making it available for a brief period of time and then sort of close it down after that if it's for a particular kind of teaching activity, maybe.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, I'm conscious of the... Oh, sorry, go on. Was there...
Pam, can I add something?
Yeah,
It's also, again, going off the point, but maybe we should look at this as an opportunity to fill in some of the gaps. So we're talking on a fairly high level of teaching. I've noticed that the South African Education Department, in their discussions about what to do on, when you're teaching online, have suggested that they cut down the material, the content, to about 50% in order to engage the students more and more. And what I was thinking was, one of the things that we have missed out all along is how to improve the quality of what we're doing as therapists ourselves in order to help the students improve what they do. So, for instance, with so-called stretches, people think that you can stretch a shoulder by doing something like this. Well, all you're doing at the best is going to be stretching the back of the shoulder capsule. But if you then indicate how you can do a better option, and then, so you get them to do it one way, and then you get them to do it a second way, so that I can, you can see that I'm going much further, and I can even start to move my not very efficient hand. If we show them how to do it, I ask them to do something in the position that they're in, and then to do it a different way, where you can demonstrate what you want to see happening, we can start to go back to the basic type of action learning and reflection in and on practice and get them to start to evaluate what they are doing themselves. So so simple stretches, for instance, the people think that they often talk to runners and so on when we are walking, and they think they're stretching the front of the hip by crunching up one leg, and people do it in the most ghastly position, but the knee's not even going past the other leg if you use your same hand. If you get them to feel what it feels like supporting one hand on the wall and using the opposite hand to the leg, you can find that you can feel that you can open up the leg completely. So this is, I'm just giving you some examples on a very simple level of how to start to use the video demonstration that you're doing to help the students get involved in figuring out what's the best way to do something for themselves. So really, even with the MNIPS, it's not just about what you're doing with your hands, but it's about how you position the patient in order to increase the effectiveness, that kind of thing. Anyway, it's way off the point of what you were discussing, but it's an idea.
No, but I think so. I had a thought around that as well, in terms of if rather than us try and find all the clips that we wanted the students to look at, there's the potential to bring some kind of criticality into this. So the learning activity could be for the students to go and find some video examples themselves of various techniques or assessment skills being done in a small group. They each go and find whatever they can, share them together, watch them, and then talk about what the differences are. Are people doing these things differently? And there's an opportunity then to get into kind of why might this person be doing it this way, why might they be doing that? Does it really make sense in terms of what the test is saying it's doing? And that can lead you on then into discussions about sort of sensitivity and specificity and all of those ideas. So if you were looking at it in a more advanced level of kind of critical thinking, there might be some nice ways to come in there where the students can kind of source the resources and then be reviewing them themselves. I'm I'm just going to come conscious of the time and that people may be wanting to leave. So I'm going to kind of start to wrap up just to say thanks to Matt for sharing the resource on threshold concepts. And to shamelessly plug something that we've also done within Beta, there's a podcast with Sarah Baradell, who wrote that paper, which, if you're interested, is worth a listen on the website. Are there any last points that anybody wants to raise that hasn't been touched on from what we've done yet?
Just one last grenade for people to think about. I think everyone, that great idea, the last idea you had was brilliant there, but I think what we've all done throughout all of this is assume the digital literacy of the people we're teaching. And I think something to think of is, are we fully understanding how well all of our students or the people that we're teaching know how to use technology efficiently?
It's a good grenade.
I'll just leave that there.
I'm going to say that might even be. So to kind of flag where we're going with this. So there is on Tuesday, and I've done it as an evening because I was conscious that people might be trying to homework and teach their kids and do all the other stuff that they're trying to juggle around at these times as well. So I've tried a couple of different times to see what works. The focus of that is going to be on assessing. So we've touched on some of those ideas, but there may be additional stuff that gets brought to that, and there might be other people who join. I think that there are some, I'm really keen to capture that it feels like there are some seismic shifts that are going to be going on both in clinical practice and in education off the back of this. And what we don't want to do is just go, oh, well, we did that for a little bit to cope with that and then all go back to what we did in the past. And actually, if we're thinking bigger picture, like how do we best use all these online resources, let's try and build something that kind of goes forward from there. So my plan would be to have another couple of conversations that touch on some of those ideas about how well prepared students are for this, what are the best approaches and tools to use to come at different types of teaching, because obviously it's much bigger than the sort of practical stuff we focused on today. So keep an eye out for those, and hopefully there'll be some interesting discussions that we can have with those in the future as well. So a couple of questions on there about another one for placements. Yes, potentially. I will try and collate. We'll put this recording out as best as it has. I don't know how well my computer recorded it because obviously my internet was dropping out a few times at the start. We'll collate the comments from the chat and try and keep making everything as useful as it can be. And if I can just close on a last request for people to be adding all of the resources that they have that they're happy to share onto the Google Doc, because there are loads of people looking at those things. Every time I come onto it, I can see loads of people are accessing it. And actually, so there's clearly a desire for this stuff out there. And I think the more of it we can pull, it's just helpful for people going forward. So I'll close on that and just say thanks to everyone. Thanks to everyone who contributed. Thanks to everyone who listened in. And hopefully see some of you next week and in the future.